You're listening to the Pithy Chronicle, history with a bite. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Erica. And we bring you history's dirtiest deeds, dripping with sarcasm.
Are you hungry yet?
Welcome back, Pithy listeners. I hope none of you deserted our crusading efforts after last episode's depressing revelations about life in 1095.
And boy, was it.
From the constant vermin to the impregnating incubi, it was a sad, often naked and starving trip down memory lane. But fear not! Today we are moving on to the nobility. Yes, that's right. Today we are going to talk about those fancy men in their oversized cod pieces.
Oh, and the pointy shoes.
And the pointy shoes. I didn't bring up the pointy shoes.
I will bring up the pointy shoes later because I actually know the guy.
What guy?
The guy who made him
the
famous.
The guy who invented. The guy who made it famous.
Yeah, okay. I don't know the guy who invented him.
I mean, you can.
Merchant class.
Oh my.
I could Google
you
it.
You said it. That's amazing. Okay. It's their time to shine in their fancy cod pieces and pointy shoes. Or not. Let's find out. Before we jump in, Erica, can you catch us up on some housekeeping, please?
Absolutely. As your cleaning goddess and guru here, must tell you that I am currently waiting on my TikTok shop scrubber to come in because I do all the TikToks for Pithy Chronicle, which is a blessing and a curse because I find all of these great things. That being said, go like us on TikTok because I've put up some fabulous things lately.
They're hilarious, but they also make you feel smart.
Yeah, they're educational.
Ish.
And sassy. We have been getting some fabulous new ratings and reviews in. Please continue to do that on whatever platform you use. Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. We're also on Amazon Podcast, but that's like a really niche
there's
thing.
There's like 95 places to find podcasts. So go find one.
We'll be happy no matter where it is.
Actually, if you're listening now, you've already found it, so good job!
Also, please go join our Patreon. We're trying to get some new content out. Always, 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 as a Patreon, get our episodes a day early.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
We often are like to the wire on putting things up, and they
you
just
get
go
it
at the
first.
Same time.
You might get it only 5 minutes early, but you get it early.
That's better.
Listen, Caroline woke up this morning and chose violence. She did. It's 5 o'clock where she is, so I would choose violence.
I'm so tired. Okay.
Finally, buy us a coffee on buyusacoffee.com/thepithychronicle.
It's a great way to throw us a buck, throw us a bone, and help keep the content.
And keep me caffeinated.
Yeah, and keep you caffeinated. All right. Today is going to be the briefest possible description of European empirical development. I am attempting to consolidate 500 plus years into roughly 15 minutes, but there really is no need to time me.
Never gonna happen.
Wow. I do not appreciate your pessimism.
Never gonna happen.
And I'm attempting this miraculous feat so that when we, dear listeners, take the cross and journey from Western Christendom to Jerusalem on the First Crusade, we will have some background information that kind of helps ground us.
Let's do it.
The Roman Empire.
Oh my gosh.
What? Okay.
Okay, keep going.
Okay, here we go. The Roman Empire, which, at its height, controlled roughly 5 million square kilometers. From Britain to Western Europe and all the way to the Middle East, as well as the top swath of Africa. It was huge.
Which I guess is why all of these men think about it 3 times a day.
But it fell. What goes up must come down.
Unless you got that blue chew.
In 476, what was once the greatest empire the world had ever seen was no more. But while it didn't exist on paper or in principle, the idea, the spark of empire still remained. And for the next 600 years, rulers tried time and again to recreate such imperial dominance. But for the moment, right after the fall, things are pretty crappy. Gaul, which had been a very important province of the once Roman Empire, was eventually taken over in the 5th and 6th centuries by the Franks, a nomadic tribe that gave its name to what is now
France.
Good guess.
Look at me.
The Franks eventually gave rise to the Merovingian dynasty.
Ooh.
Oh, God. Whom Erica is obsessed with, and whose most favorite king was Clovis, and he converted the entire kingdom to Catholicism, giving the Frankish Merovingian dynasty respectability in the eyes of the papacy. It was very important that the papacy recognize this dynasty because the papacy is still the dominant and consistent power throughout the Middle Ages. Christianity is ruling people's lives one way or another in Western Christendom. The Merovingians did a few important things. First, they established the hereditary right to rule, which was not common in Europe at the time. We all think of those later dynasties in the 15th, 16th centuries, but at the moment that was very unclear. So good job, Merovingians, I guess. They also created a feudal system wherein kings handed out territories to their trusted counts, who administered them at the local level. But this decentralization of power eventually decreased monarchical power. And as they say, all good things must come to an end, including the Merovingians, who were eventually deposed in 751 by their own administrators, who came to be known as the Carolingians.
Mm-hmm.
So awkward to be taken over by your basically housekeepers.
I mean, it's actually pretty funny because that happens again with the Stuarts.
It's not uncommon that the people who are actually handling the day-to-day stuff and making the tough decisions and not just fooling around and fiddling with themselves on their throne, that they end up getting the power when all hell breaks loose.
It also happens in the Islamic world, which we'll talk about next week.
The Carolingians began as the majordomos, or the like household leaders of the Merovingian dynasty. But a succession of extremely able majordomos and extremely unable kings consolidated power, and eventually Pepin the Short claimed the kingship as a result of his many victories.
Bad name, though.
Oh, yeah. The Carolingians tended to name their people after their faults. Most of their names are not all that flattering.
At least we know now the origin of the short king.
Oh,
the short king
that's
trend.
True.
Pepin.
And I mean, his name makes him seem short.
It is a short guy name.
Fairy-like name. Pepin.
Pepin.
Pope Stephen II legitimized Pepin the Short. Mostly because Pepin helped the Pope rid his lands of these annoying Lombards who were constantly marauding.
And he gave the land for the Vatican.
And then he gave the land that he saved to become the Papal States. So yes, Pepin had to earn his title, if you will. However it happened, Pepin, through this papal coronation, became a legitimate king in the eyes of Western Christendom. Goodbye, Merovingians. Hello, Carolingians. And while you might not have heard of Pepin, you've likely heard of his son,
Charlemagne.
Really? You're gonna sing it?
Okay.
You think he deserves a song?
I mean, he was not a good person, but he achieved some pretty great things.
That's true. He is perhaps the greatest medieval ruler. He did so many good things, as Erica said, at least for himself and his empire. He campaigned tirelessly and advanced the frontiers of his empire in pretty much every direction. He recreated an imperial order in Western Europe for the first time in about 3 centuries. On Christmas Day of 800 AD, now you should be singing, Charlemagne was crowned Emperor of the Romans with a grand papal coronation in Rome. He was now the Holy Roman Emperor. This put him on a whole new level, close to the previous Roman imperial situation, but he was smart enough to insist on hereditary succession. No more of this democratic nonsense. Through his papal coronation, he also forever linked the fortunes of the Holy Roman Empire with that of the papacy. But all good things, again, must come to an end. Charlemagne passed on his hereditary empire to his son, singular, Louis the Pious, who, in the Carolingian fashion, his monarchical name instills very little of the military might that his father would have wished. Louis the Pious, in turn passed it down to his sons. As in three.
It never works. It
doesn't work. The Merovingians tried and failed. And rather than conferring the crown as a single entity with all that it entails, the grandsons of Charlemagne decided to divvy up the spoils. They clearly weren't history lovers. If they'd had any sense at all, they'd have looked back like just one century earlier to see what happens when you divide territories and lose centralized power. But hey, it's their choices, and they're going to live with the consequences.
Boy, howdy.
From Charlemagne's imperial visions of a Holy Roman Empire, we now have three smaller kingdoms. The Western Frankish Kingdom, the Eastern Frankish Kingdom, and Lotharingia. The Western Frankish Kingdom is what is today's France, sort of. We're just going to go with that.
Yeah.
The Eastern is today's Western Germany, Switzerland, and Austria-ish. And Lotharingia, which was named for Lothar, the eldest of the three idiot sons, was the Middle Kingdom, or today's Lorraine region. The borders, when drawn on a map, look a bit odd and haphazard, but it did make sense. All three brothers received roughly equal amounts of royal property, and the kingdoms took into account pre-existing vassaldoms, which was actually quite thoughtful of them. Lothar, as the eldest, received within Lotharingia the two capitals of Aachen and Rome. Also, he gets the papal proclamation of Holy Roman Emperor. So now the Holy Roman Emperor really only rules over one-third of that little empire.
Yeah.
This division of Western Christendom pretty much defined everything that came after in terms of borders and lines, and it saw a shift from consolidated power to a feudal system, wherein lands were granted as rewards for military service. As we discussed last time, coined money was extremely scarce in these dark ages, and kings didn't have a lot of it, and they also really didn't have a huge income. They just had a title, so they used these land grants to reward their supporters, and in return, these supporters fielded an army that could be called upon for military aid. Vassals swore homage to their lords, which was a religious rite sanctified by the Catholic Church and created a definite hierarchical status, if not necessarily a status of power, if that makes sense. Fiefs, or this feudal structure, became the political organization of medieval Europe. And as you might have guessed, the division of the Carolingian Empire into three separate but equal states plunged Europe into 100 years of civil wars, along with Viking attacks, Hungarian invasions, Arab raids, and so on and so on. Between 840 and 940 AD, Western Europe was continually under siege with itself. Kings and emperors lost control to their vassals at a far more local level. It was the vassals who actually held all the military force. So, when Pope Urban II preached for holy war in 1095 at the Council of Clermont, he did so to the three great monarchies that were slowly forming from the ruins of the Carolingian chaos. France, England, and the Holy Roman Empire, the much reduced Holy Roman Empire. We'll do France first, the leftovers of what was formerly that Western Frankish kingdom. Ruled?
Loosely.
Loosely, yes, thank you. Ruled loosely by King Philip I. France, as we know it, was really just the traditional lands around modern-day Paris, and not like all of modern-day Paris, just the very center bits. It was honestly kind of a small town. Sorry, Paris. King Philip ruled by the right of hereditary succession, which, again, was a big deal. We will not see that everywhere, but he had adapted a very certain succession plan, so good on them. Philip and his ancestors actually weren't even descended from the Carolingians because that line had died out. In 987, Hugh Capet, Philip's ancestor, was elected by the French nobility, which gave him the royal title of king and was contingent upon the French Catholic Church anointing him. This gave the Capetian monarchy, Philip I, some influence over his lands in kind of a religious sense, but other than that, he was remarkably weak.
It's just sad.
A king with no power is just embarrassing. The Carolingian line, as I said, had gone extinct, and therefore the local vassals had become incredibly powerful. Counts and dukes, which are actually just old Roman military titles. Mm-hmm. I think that's cool.
It is very cool.
Now held authority as independent agents or rulers of their own territories. The major players in this French empire were Burgundy, Brittany, Aquitaine, Flanders, Toulouse, and Normandy. Normandy was actually a late bloomer. The Duchy of Normandy was created in 911 when the Viking leader Rollo, which if you've seen that show The Vikings.
Oh, I have.
Oh, you have. Rollo was given the land in recognition of his military service.
Maybe I'm just hungry, but every time I see Rollo, I think of the candies.
Oh,
chocolate, and they have like caramel in the menu. They're so delicious.
I mean, the irony that like very prickly man is now synonymous with a sweet and gooey candy.
Technically an ancestor.
Rollo was given the land in recognition of his military service. While most of the counts and dukes at least pretended to take the whole rite of homage seriously, Rollo did not. When told to kiss the foot of the French king, which I guess is like a thing that they used to do, and considering what they walked upon and with and in, no.
Especially since Rollo, the Vikings were so much cleaner overall than...
Yeah, Rollo looked at that foot and said, hell no. Instead, he told one of his men to do it, and that Viking just yanked the king's foot, pulling him from his chair and forcing him over onto his back. So clearly, the king wasn't exactly scary or all-powerful. Mm-mm. The newly minted Dukes of Normandy were Vikings that intermarried with the local population and adapted the local language. But they were still Vikings. And as we will hear next time in Erica's episode about the Byzantine Empire, when Alexios asks for Western Christendom's aid, he specifically asks for the Normans. He wants the Vikings.
And that just did not go to plan.
It did
not. Spoilers.
They didn't show up. Other people did. Unhelpful people. The six leading nobles, known as the Peers of France, held strong authority. And while they technically owed liege homage to the Capetian King of France, the king, in actual fact, was entirely dependent on their goodwill and whatever marriage connections he could make. France was not governed from Paris. In fact, there really wasn't a France as we know it at all. Among the various duchies, there was no political, cultural, or even linguistic unity. They were very separate. So that's France. And now we're going to board a boat, cross the channel, and sail to England.
Woohoo!
Which is just what the Duke of Normandy, about 150 years later, mm-hmm. William the Conqueror did in 1066.
He showed up as Billy the Bastard and left as Willy the Conk.
Agreed. But the
Do you
Conk?
Not call him
no,
Willy
we've
the Conk?
No, we've discussed this on many episodes because Willy the Conk.
That's his name to me.
Willy the Conk.
Willy the Conk.
Every time you say it, I hear Willy the Cock. I'm sorry. Which, it works well with Willy. And so, anyway, he came in 1066. Previously controlled by Anglo-Saxon kings, England was already very well structured via shires and counties. And William immediately and dramatically took England and brought over that feudal system he'd inherited in Normandy. But unlike the lazy Capetian kings, William and his heirs kept very close tabs on their vassals, maintaining one of the most effectively ruled kingdoms in Western Europe at the time. However, England was still a feudal system. William and his dependents had to adhere to the traditions of homage and needed the goodwill of their vassals. They also, interestingly and very complicatedly, remained French vassals of the Capetian king. So, King of England, but only Duke of Normandy.
Oh,
and that created a tension for the next, 900 years. But we're not dealing with it today, I'm just putting it out there in the world.
Thank God. I don't know that I can handle the stress.
So that's England, which really didn't participate in the First Crusade, but it will begin to play a larger part down the crusading line, because there are just so many in which to partake. finally, we have the Holy Roman Empire, created from the leftovers of Lotharingia and the Eastern Frankish Kingdom. It combined today's Germany, Eastern France, Low Countries, Alpine regions, Northern and Central Italy. It was pretty darn big. Mm-hmm. And its most important or most influential ruler was Otto I. He gained the imperial title, a leftover of that Middle Kingdom Lotharingia, in 962. He traveled to Rome to be crowned the Holy Roman Emperor. But unlike the King of France, the Holy Roman Emperor was not a hereditary position. Don't get me wrong, they tried and tried and tried. But the five major dukes of the Holy Roman Empire, similar to the peers of France, they retained the power to elect their leader, and they never caved. So, kudos.
Good for you.
Political authority broke down to the local level. Not to the extreme that we have in France, but enough that the Holy Roman Emperor never really felt entirely secure. And so, when Urban II preached his Great Crusade, he got his main response not from these three feudal kings of these three great monarchies, but rather from their lords and vassals, the nobility of the Holy Roman Empire and France. Less so from England, but we're going to cross that channel when we get to it. It made...
That's a good one.
Thank you so much. It made sense, because the feudal lords were the ones who truly had consolidated their power. Over the last 150 years, they had devised traditions of homage and vassalage of their own. They had also pioneered new warfare techniques during that 100 years of civil war. And they'd reduced brigand lords and unruly knights under their authority. They brought back political and social order to the darkness of Western Europe. Whereas those great kings still ruled effectively from horseback, they had to travel to exact feudal dues to make their presence known. Their authority was completely or almost completely dependent upon their nobility. The kings could not afford to leave their domains for months, much less years, to take the cross and go on crusade. But these powerful nobles, who had centuries of warfaring techniques and training under their belts, whose lands were stable and secure, these men were able to take up the call of Urban II. And that is 11th century Western Christendom in a nutshell.
A teeny tiny nutshell.
It was a good nutshell.
It was a good nutshell.
It was like a walnut.
It was good.
Next week, we're going to explore the two other world players within the Crusades, the Byzantine Empire and the Islamic world. But for now, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Erica, and we are Pithily Yours.
This episode is brought to you by the Pithy Chronicle, LLC. The Pithy Chronicle is intended for education, entertainment, and non-commercial purposes. Any views or opinions expressed in this podcast are personal and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the owner may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity. While we offer lots of sarcasm, this podcast does not offer any advice or services. Listening to this podcast may induce fits of laughter, unexpected distraction, or uncontrollable rage at the subjects, hopefully not at us. We hope you learned something today. If not, so sorry. Please be advised we are not experts in the following fields: medical, legal, financial, technological, thermonuclear engineering, submarine warfare, neuroscience, or cat husbandry. Thanks for listening to our little disclaimer. Just covering our history-loving asses. Bye!